course, it's the solution to all problems, turning it on and off usually.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of the EdTech Podcast. This week, I missed the launch of the Institute for Ethical AI in Education as I was hiking along the Lizard Peninsula in Cornwall with only the blazing October sun to keep me company. Fear not, however, dear listeners, as we will be asking Sir Anthony Seldon, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Buckingham and one third of the Institute leadership, what the programme is all about next week as part of a future episode on AI in education. This should set me up nicely for the panel I'm moderating on AI in education at the Global Education Technology event in Beijing next month. If you're heading out to GET in China, I look forward to seeing you there. Come on, Chinese visa, don't let me down now. Returning back to this week's episode, we've got a listener's message bonanza to kick us off. First up, apologies to Kirsty Tonks, Principal Designate of Shiloh Collegiate Academy, for missing her voicemail to the show a few weeks back.
Hi there, everyone at the EdTech Podcast. This is Kirsty Tonks from Shiloh Collegiate Academy Trust up in the West Midlands. I am super excited about coming down tonight, ready for tomorrow's festival. I'm really looking forward to speaking about how I've led digital change and transformation over the last 12 years. So I'm going to say bye now and see you all tomorrow.
Thanks, Kirsty, for sending in your message and contributing to our festival. Thanks also to listener and mega fan Malwina Koska from Inspiral Education and previously of Apple fame for leaving such a complimentary message about the festival.
Hi, Sophie. This is just a quick one to say a huge thank you for organizing such a brilliant event. I absolutely love the EdTech Podcast Festival, and I felt super energized, super inspired, and I had really meaningful conversations during all day. So congrats one more time. I think we all needed this type of event in EdTech. So thank you. Staying your biggest fan. Have a great rest of your day. All the best, Malwina. Bye.
We are working on a special new format for podcast listeners and festival fans, so more soon on that. If you want to leave a message for the show, go to speakpipe.com/the EdTech Podcast. This week, we also have a message from Dr. Ananda Gopalan, the lead coordinator for the Communicating Computer Science in the Classroom programme at Imperial College London. Ananda organises the placement of awesome Imperial College London undergraduates into schools to teach and inspire around real-world computer science learning. If you'd like an undergrad in your classroom and you're listening in London, get in touch with Ananda, whose email is in our show notes. Here he is describing the programme.
So this is a course that's titled Communicating Computer Science in Schools, which runs as a third or fourth year module. So these are upper level undergraduate students who actually take this course in lieu of another course in the department. And the aim of this course is to place these undergraduate students with the London area school for a period of about 6 to 8 weeks, where they would support the teaching of computer science in the school itself. So the idea is for them to get a first-hand experience of the school environment and actually help deliver a program of teaching. This program of teaching would be agreed with the student and the teacher and can take the form of curriculum-based teaching or teaching outside the curriculum, which could be code clubs, different types of activities, programming activities, algorithmic activities, as well as anything that the school thinks is interesting. For example, they could even talk about computer science outside the curriculum and how computer science is actually being used in the real world. And the way that we pick the students is we actually interview all of them to ensure that they're suitable to go to the schools to teach. Mm-hmm. And we take care of all the necessary costs. So every student who gets to a school will be DBS checked by us. And if there are any travel costs that are incurred by the students, we take care of the travel costs as well.
That's very cool. And so what's the kind of results that you've had back from some of your students going into the schools?
The feedback we've had from the schools have been absolutely positive, very, very positive, because they obviously get really good students, and they're also getting students who are doing this as a subject and are hoping to do this as part of a career. So they really get a good understanding. Plus, what we hear back from our students is the fact that the ground reality in schools is not very, very good in terms of the number of technical teachers available in the schools. A lot of schools are making do with somehow managing to teach the computing curriculum, but it's a stopgap solution. Last year, we had a student go to a local school where they took over the teaching of a certain element of the curriculum, which was to teach students understanding of low-level programming about the whole idea of what a computer looks like from the inside. And in order to be able to do this, the student actually built a mock-up machine in terms of allowing them to play around with it online. So the students got a very good understanding because our student could build a tool that allows them to understand that. And it was absolutely outstanding that the student was able to do that in 6 to 8 weeks. Another student, for example, a few years ago, went and taught them pretty much the entire half the curriculum that we teach our students about a particular programming language, and really kept it at the cutting edge, which meant that students, so this was taught to students at a slightly higher batch level, so they were doing their GCSE and A levels, which meant that students actually got a good understanding of what computing would be like in the real world, or what would they be learning as students in a computing degree. And you could kind of see the reactions of the students based on whatever was mentioned in the report, that they really got their eyes open, being like, oh my God, this is what computing is like, rather than ICT, which is kind of what was the curriculum for many, many years. So it's important for students to be able to get an understanding of what computing in the real world is, not just spilling up spreadsheets and data, but actually be able to program the underlying environments, which really gets them very excited. Another student actually taught took Raspberry Pis to schools and then allowed them to program elements of Minecraft on it, which was also extremely exciting because the student built the framework around it a little bit and basically took it to the school, and it proved to be very, very successful.
If schools are listening in and they are interested in working with your program and getting some of your students into their schools, how do they go about doing that?
That's a good question. So all they need to do is email me, and we can set it up based on our discussions with the school. The schools don't need to submit any paperwork. The only thing the schools need to do is to have a commitment that they're happy to take our student, happy to take care of them, because our students are still students. They're not necessarily teachers. So they need to be, the environment has to be such that the students feel comfortable delivering the lessons. And that's all that we ask from the schools, as a matter of fact. And we've got schools engaging from primary to A levels. So we've got a wide range of schools. And if we can't get a student to go the first year, maybe we could get them to go the year after. So we kind of try to mix and match schools with our students' interest, but also with respect to where they live in London and how much commute time they can have.
Okay, fantastic. So we'll drop your email into our show notes.
Absolutely.
And anyone listening, get in touch with Ananda and we'll make that happen.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to connect with many more schools. We're also looking to expand our outreach as part of this course, is to use this connection with schools to actually expand the kind of outreach that we plan as well. So this would be a good way to engage with us. Even if we are not able to engage through this course, we can always engage with other ways from the department.
Thanks, Ananda. We love all that, and a great way of bringing together the Ed and the Tech. With more news on what brings together the Ed and the Tech or doesn't, here is Bob Harrison, who got in touch after penning his article for Secondary Ed in the UK, responding to the UK Education Secretary's 5-point agenda on where tech might help in education. Bob's main point is that the UK government announcement doesn't go far enough. Can you tell?
Right. So I'm getting towards the end of my career in life now. I'm chair of governors of a college in Barnsley. I'm on the governing body of Oldham College here in the Northwest. I'm vice chair of governors of my local secondary modern, because there's a secondary modern bum myself. I think it's important that I try and put something back in. But I've spent 40 years working in schools and colleges. And then when I retired as a principal of a big FE college in the late 1990s, I went to work for Toshiba as their education advisor for Northern Europe. So I've had, you know, 35 years in education and still in education, but I also had a very interesting 15 years working in the tech industry for Toshiba, Northern Europe. So my perspective, you know, it comes from having lived with and worked with and married to teachers. I've got children who are teachers. So my perspective is very heavily grounded in teaching and learning, but with a tech perspective. And of course, my most famous claim to fame was I sat on the ministerial education technology advisory group set up by Matthew Hancock when he was the FE and skills minister. Mm-hmm. And they were called FELTAG and ETAG, which fortunately FELTAG is still been having an impact in further education learning technologies action group. Mm-hmm. In fact, I chaired a conference last week at the TUC, FELTAG 5 years on. Sadly, the Education Technology Action Group, chaired by Stephen Heppel, reported, and the three ministers that had commissioned it got sacked or got reshuffled, and the report got buried. So I've had a range of experience, but I'm still active. I'm passionate about the potential that technology has got to transform learning, teaching and assessment. But sadly, as the article in SecEd highlights, I'm struggling to get enthusiastic about the Damien Hines recent epiphany about how technology can transform teaching and learning and assessment, because it ignores the context in which most of us in education are working at the moment, which is summed up by Paul Haig, the head teacher at King Egbert School in Sheffield, who said in the article, the quote that he gave me was, you know, any ideas of using technology to transform learning and teaching and assessment and a pure nostalgia now, because we've had 6 or 7 years of complete neglect and a deconstruction of the support systems. And that's what the article really says. So whilst the Secretary of State might think it's a great epiphany, and his article in the Daily Telegraph in the middle of August, I mean, you know, how many teachers read the Daily Telegraph in the middle of August, I think the civil servants thought it was a great breakthrough. Personally, you know, I think we've got a lot of work to do to make up. And I'm sorry, but, you know, a short puff piece in the Daily Telegraph identifying five areas of potential opportunity for the use of technology with no money attached, I'm afraid doesn't really wash it, particularly when, you know, Damien Hines managed to find £50 million to expand grammar schools. So we can expand selection and find £50 million. But if we want to improve teaching, learning and assessment with the use of technology, which I believe is not only desirable but essential if you want to prepare our young people for a future in a digital world, we can't find anything other than a puff piece in the Daily Telegraph. So some might call me cynical. some might say I'm sceptical. I know I'm not flavour of the month with the DfE at the moment, but then again, you know, I take that as a badge of honour, because I see what's happening in our schools and colleges, and frankly, we are not preparing our young people for the future in the digital world. And despite what ministers say, there's an awful lot of work to do to make up for the neglect and lack of political leadership over the last 5 or 6 years.
I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, you know,
if, for example, in a twist of fate, you were suddenly leading that EdTech policy team at the DfE, what would be the first three things you would do if you were in that position?
Okay. Well, first of all, I would not necessarily, I wouldn't put something in the Daily Telegraph. If we're going to bring about change in the education system, it's not going to happen by being led by people from Microsoft or Google or Intel or Apple or Toshiba or anybody else, I'm afraid. Teachers are the people that will bring about this change. And in order, and from my experience in working with teachers will be inspired by and will believe what other teachers tell them. So my starting point will be, let's not start with asking industry what they can do. I mean, in fairness to industry, and, you know, I would, you know, my colleagues at Toshiba and Microsoft and Apple, they and Google, they spend an awful lot already. You know, I mean, CPD programs, you know, the Distinguished Educator programs, mm-hmm. and, you know, all those. So the industry's already doing a lot, but I'm afraid the motivation for change has to come from within the education sector, and that means teachers. So I would start, not dissimilar to the work we did with Feltag, by identifying a vision. What's the vision for my grandchildren? Six of them will be leaving school in between 2027 and 2037. Now, just you imagine, Sophie, the technology that you and I are using now for this podcast, and reflect on the changes in technology you and I have been got used to in the last 18 months, 12, 18 months. And then fast forward and project that to 2027, to 2037. So the first thing we have to do, the first thing I would do if I was in charge, would be work with the education community to develop a vision of what learning will be looking like. And sadly, this is going to sound party political, but it's not. Sadly, we have a schools minister who frankly believes in a pedagogical approach which takes us back to the 19th century rather than preparing our young people for the third millennium. So that'd be the first thing I'd do. The second thing I'd do would make sure that all schools and colleges, and this was one of the recommendations of ETAG, had a robust and industrial style infrastructure. So super fast broadband, enough investment to make sure that the kit works. Because one of the things that puts teachers off innovating with technology is they're frightened it's going to fall over and not work. And, you know, I've taught motor vehicle 4 on a Friday afternoon, and the last thing you want is the PowerPoint to go down or whatever technology you're trying to use, because you're going to get eaten alive. So the second thing that I would do after developing the vision is invest in the infrastructure. And the third thing is about workforce capacity and capability. And as Paul Hague said, sadly, in his quote from my article in SecEd, at this moment in time, it's a case of, you know, which staff do I want to hang on to? Which staff am I going to have to make redundant in order to make the budget cuts? So I think we've got to look at the cultural context. And so the three things that I will do will be vision, infrastructure, and workforce skills. And if I can add a fourth, if it's Desert Island.
It's a bonus one.
Desert Island dish. If I had a fourth, the fourth one would be to look very carefully at the regulatory framework that we've currently got. So Ofsted, Ofqual, the funding agency, and look at the way that we hidebound our teachers. I mean, the assessment process, let's just take that for an example. We are currently teaching children using technology and everything like that. And it's like them learning to drive in Formula One cars and then using them, asking them to ride a horse for their assessments, because they're essentially writing on A4 sides of paper for an hour and a half and everything like that. So the assessment system, the inspection system, and the funding system at this moment inhibit innovation with the use of technology. So I think that those would be my four things. It's unlikely to happen, kid, I have to tell you. I'm not likely to get into a position of power to do that, but if I was, that's what I would do.
Well, hopefully we'll try and invite one of the policy team on to come and give their perspective as well, and that would be
great to discuss
with them. Thanks, Bob. It's almost like your magic wand is working, with the latest Ofsted announcement downgrading the role of assessments in the overall measurement of quality teaching. What's next? Bob and I also talked about the difficulty of creating an educator vision when there is such disagreement on what makes good teaching and learning, but we also agreed on the knowledge versus skills choice being a false dichotomy, something that comes up in this week's episode with Schools Week. We'd love to hear back from the DfE on the latest developments. Let's see. Delivering some of those latest developments, the British Educational Suppliers Association, or BESA, are working with the Department for Education to develop an online portal to feature impactful edtech products. The portal, titled LendEd, is currently in development phase and BESA are seeking feedback. To give the portal a road test, go to our show notes for the version 1 login. Continuing the theme of English educational policy, it's now time for this week's episode, the Schools Week live recording from our podcast festival with Catherine Murray, digital editor, and Jess Stauffenberg, senior reporter at Schools Week, commenting on everything from Ofsted to Damien Hine back in late September. If you're listening in around the world, do get in touch to let us know what you think. Lots of interesting stories from school transparency to national computing success. Here we go.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for coming along. This is the Schools Week podcast at the EdTech Festival. What are we doing today, Kath?
Today we're going to review the big stories from this week's news agenda. So I think we're going to start with the computing GCSE story because that's very relevant to this audience. So Jess, would you like to let us know what's been happening?
I would indeed. So lots of you will know a lot of this already, but the computer science GCSE, it came in quite a few years ago. It was sort of introduced as a way of getting something more academic, focusing on coding and programming, and it was introduced back in 2015. And what we have now is a situation, Kath. The problem is that lots of girls aren't taking the subject, and lots of people from pupil premium aren't taking the subject either. Basically, because it's really, really kind of nerdy is the talk on the ground.
So I'm a little confused, because what I heard was that it was a good curriculum, that a lot of the computer science people had got behind this curriculum. So what's gone wrong?
So it was designed by the British Computer Society, and they came up with this idea, you know, oh, let's have a really coding heavy qualification. But then Nick Gibb got rid of the ICT GCSE, and this summer was the very last summer that students got to do the ICT GCSE, which was a lot broader. So that's probably what you remember from school, some of you, Excel, PowerPoint, even things like iMovie. And now all they've got is coding. So there's a big drop-off in the number of girls doing it, and a big drop-off in a 17% drop in the number of pupils taking any sort of computing qualification now, because they're not choosing the computer science coding-focused GCSE.
So what do we need to do? Do we need to, rather than keep computing as its own strand in the curriculum, do we need to do something to broaden how computing is embedded across schools, across the curriculum? What can we do?
Well, ironically, the people who actually designed the computer science GCSE, British Computer Society, they've kind of said, it might not be working. Let's do a review. So they've got a very impressive professor of computer science who's going to be leading a review to say, does this need to actually be a broader curriculum, broader qualification, and bring back in some of the elements that's been lost in ICT? So there's a lot of grumbling on the ground that the people who actually came up with this idea are now reviewing it and might sort of tweak it back into more of its older version. And we're going to have to see what they come up with, essentially.
I was talking to some computer science teachers today, and one of the things that they said, interestingly, was in English, you've got literacy embedded across the curriculum, for example. You've got, you know, maths embedded across the curriculum. What we don't seem to have is computing embedded across the curriculum. And I do wonder if Damien Hines' new push for the strands of computing throughout schools is going to help with this. Hopefully it will. And I guess it remains to be seen whether this the tension in the DfE. We've got Damien Hines pushing for an edtech revolution, and then we've got Nick Gibb with his more focus on traditional education. And I suppose the tension that we're going to see in the coming years is who wins that battle, or do we find something that works for everybody, that makes computing and coding for the future something that we as a country are good enough at for future industries?
There is that tension, isn't there? And I think what the government has come up with is this National Centre for Computing Education, and that's their big idea. It's meant to be launching very shortly, literally in a matter of weeks, and I think they're going to try and work out some of these tensions. It's got £84 million, so hopefully... We've had a few false starts with computing, but hopefully it's going to get off the ground, Kath, isn't
it? Let's see. Hopefully, maybe it will follow the footsteps of the Math Centre, that National Math Centre that we have that, you know, kind of hopefully gives a bit of a push to math in the curriculum. Maybe computing will go the same way. We shall see.
We've got our fingers crossed. Talking about politicians trying to make everything work, what else are the good political stories from this week, Kath? What else has caught your eye?
Well, politics-wise, of course, we had Angela Rayner make her first big announcement on the long-awaited National Education Service. Now, 2 years we've been waiting to see what the National Education Service is actually going to contain. Anybody aware of any policies in the National Education Service so far? So this week, we have an announcement on two, and interestingly enough, they're not revolutionary. They are actually recycling of old policies that the Tories came up with a few years ago.
So which one's she gone for? What's she nabbed, Kath?
So the big one that made the headlines was this one about trying to deal with off-rolling. So exclusions has been big in the headlines especially in recent months, school exclusions. One of the policies that Angela Rayner has proposed to deal with this is that schools stay accountable for the GCSE results of any student that they remove from their role in the years coming up to GCSEs. So I think this is a fairly uncontroversial policy. And actually, it was first revealed by Nikki Morgan in 2015 in her white paper for Education Excellence Everywhere. It got support from across the spectrum. So really what's happened here is the Tories have missed a trick. They never implemented that policy. It's just fallen by the wayside. And now Angela Rayner's picked up that policy and made a big headline splash with it. And I think it's, to be honest, broadly popular across...
Sounds pretty smart from Rayner because, you know, she's going with something that members support, which is the National Education Service, and she's keeping quite traditional lines on that. But behind the scenes, it sounds like maybe she's being a bit more pragmatic, a bit more savvy, looking at stuff which already has cross-party support. Does that sound fair?
Absolutely. I think that's just what she's doing. And in fact, the other policy was the census loophole policy. Again, a non-controversial policy to do with exclusions is that at the moment, I think anyone who works in schools knows that the funding for the year is calculated by the autumn census, and then the accountability measures are calculated on the January census. So there's like a loophole, there's a window in which it's ideal time for schools to lose pupils. If you lose them after the autumn census, before the January census, you lose the funding, so you gain the funding, but you lose the results.
That's really interesting.
So it's an obvious loophole to close, and it's another big easy win policy that will get broad support across the schools. So yeah, she's being very pragmatic.
So Rayner coming up with some good ideas. And in fact, there was a pretty popular story. We had a lot of hits on this week. It was about Drew Povey, who's obviously the star of Educating Manchester, and he's been one of those accused of off-rolling. Do you want to just quickly put that in a nutshell?
That's an interesting story. So Educating Greater Manchester, a big hit series. In fact, so such a big hit that they commissioned a second series, which was supposed to be due out for the autumn. I'm not sure now what the timescale is. So yes, he's been on suspension for several months over accusations of fiddling the figures, possibly to do with off-rolling, having previously given evidence that Education Select Committee that his school did not exclude any pupils. So big name, high profile, gone out against exclusions and is now under investigation. I think, to be honest, the biggest story and the most relevant thing about that story is this issue of transparency. Will we ever know what happened to Drew Povey? Will we ever know the story behind his case? Actually, it's possible we might not. And the reason for this links back into Angela Rayner here. Go with me for a second. So Drew Povey's school is council maintained. If we as journalists want to get information about that review into investigation into Drew Povey, we're not going to be given the documents. If we wanted to do the same thing in an academy, we'd be able to request those documents and see what had gone on behind the scenes.
So there's potentially more transparency in the academy system. What's actually Angela Rayner said about academies? Is she going to scrap them?
So interestingly, Angela Rayner's base and the National Education Union, which might be seen to be more Angela Rayner's base, is against academisation. They're anti-academy by policy. And Angela Rayner has come out to say she's not anti-academy. She doesn't mind whether your school is an academy or a maintained school. It's all about, is it a good school? Which I think is very pragmatic, to be honest. And especially in this sense, academies are more transparent than local authority schools. They have their problems. We've all seen the scandals. But they also, local authority maintained schools are not a panacea, and they do have big problems of their own, especially over this transparency issue. So Angela Rayner coming down hard on academies, saving her money not to put into school structures, not into rolling back academies, but saving her money to pledge it, if she does have money for education, to pledge it into teacher pay and into school budgets, is a very smart move.
Okay, so on to pay now. So we've had a bit on computing, a bit on Angela Rayner and politics, but pay is the thing that really gets teachers hot under the collar. Understandably, they're an incredibly hardworking profession. And it was, I think, our biggest hits this week, wasn't it, Kath, was our teacher pay stories. So last week, we've done a number of stories, but you may know that teachers have been told that they're going to be eligible for a 3.5% pay rise if they're in the unqualified or main pay scale, a little bit less. The government decided against the advice of the school teachers review body, but 2% for teachers on the upper pay range and a 1.5% rise for all those very hardworking teachers and school leaders. So
Hold on, that does seem like a sensible policy to me. I might be going out on a limb there. But if you have limited money for schools, doesn't it make more sense to pay the teachers on the lower salaries more, especially if we have retention and recruitment problems in the lower ends?
I think that was the thinking, Kath. I think the only problem is we actually also have a head teacher retention and recruitment crisis, slightly. Crisis might be too strong a word. So lots of heads came out and said, look, what kind of a reward is this for heads that they don't get the same level of an increase? But yeah, I see what you're saying. However, so Schools Week did a little bit of digging into this, and one of the things that we were looking at is whether schools would be left short by this pay rise, sort of, because what the government said is it's fully funded. They seem to have a number of caveats in. First of all, the first 1%, you may be aware, schools actually have to cover themselves, because the idea is there is a 1% pay cap anyway, so that schools would have budgeted for that anyway. So already schools have got to meet the first 1% themselves. And the government said, oh, we'll do the remainder.
And there's something else, isn't there, to do with what kind of teachers you have in your school as to whether you're going to get the right amount of money. Explain that to me.
This is it. So there's kind of two elements to it. First of all, if you're a special educational needs school, I was speaking to some last week, and I know of one that's going to be £3,500 short. This
is that
year,
because they need more highly qualified teachers?
This is because they have a higher staff to pupil ratio. So for example, this particular school I think had 270 pupils but 29 classes. A normal mainstream school would have 270 pupils but 9 classes. So there's loads of teachers. And the key point here is that the government are going to fund the pay rise based on pupil numbers, not on staff numbers, if that makes sense.
So it's it seems fair in the sense that if you've got an overstaffed school, you don't want to overly reward them.
Right. And the government needs to come up with a quick way of working out how much everybody was owed. There is actually a higher rate for special needs schools to account for this issue, that they'll have more staff. But it looks like, at least in a number of schools we've spoken to, another one I spoke to is going to be £5,000 short. It's still not quite making up the money. Some schools are going to be out of pocket.
And then what about schools who've got more teachers at the higher end of a pay scale? That's going to be a problem too, is
right?
That right?
So the actual main pay scale, it's not one salary. It goes from about £22,000 up to a little bit over £30,000, I think. So it's within itself varied, and that's the scale that will have 3.5% increase. Bear with us here. We know this is really nerdy. We are very nerdy about this kind of thing. But the issue is that, therefore, if you have way more teachers at the upper end of the scale, you're going to have to dole out more cash to them, theoretically, for that 2.5% increase than if you've got a lot of teachers at the bottom end of the scale. So a school with loads of inexperienced teachers could potentially end up with more cash left over from the lump sum given them to the government than a school with lots of teachers on a higher pay. Because if both schools have exactly the same number of pupils, the same sector, the same area of the country, they're going to get the same lump sum. It basically doesn't take into account staff numbers or how expensive your staff are.
So I think what I'm hearing here is that if you have a lot of NQTs, rather than you've done a good job of retaining staff, you're going to be potentially penalised financially.
Potentially. We need to hear from people. If there's anyone who's in that type of school who wants to tell us how much you're short or in surplus, that would be great. But that's what we're anticipating.
Okay.
So one of the issues, of course, when you don't have enough money in your coffers in schools, what usually suffers, I'd say, what gets cut is things like teaching supports and also the curriculum, Kath. And that was one of our other big stories this week, wasn't it?
It was. We've had a curriculum blog written by the Chief Inspector of Schools, Amanda Spielman, who, as we all know, has been focusing on curriculum for the last couple of years. So broad and balanced curriculum is a big catchphrase for Amanda, which is great. I think a lot of people can get behind that, a broad and balanced curriculum. Where we have a problem, obviously, is where we run into clashes with what the government requires of schools in terms of accountability.
It's got SATs, the EBAC, is that the idea that there's a narrowing down?
Exactly. So at primary level, for example, Key Stage 2 primary, you've got English and math SATs that they're all working towards, and often what you see is a narrowing of the curriculum in year six towards a focus on English and maths. And what Amanda Spielman has been saying is, we want to see you teaching a broad and balanced curriculum. We want science, we want geography, history, art, music, all those things being taught to students. It's not about your exam results, it's about, do you give them a broad education?
So what's she done now, Kath? What's this blog saying?
So the latest blog from Amanda Spielman is that they've looked at 23 schools, all identified for having a particular curriculum focus. And they've gone into those schools, sent an inspector in for a day, and talked to the school leaders about how they are structuring their curriculum, how they're designing their curriculum, how they're trying to ensure that it is broad and balanced. And this blog was a review of what's happened.
Right. And is this, I mean, what kinds of schools are this? Is this all, we know that there's a preference for knowledge-rich curriculums in schools. Is this all knowledge-rich schools that got looked at, or...
So knowledge-rich schools is a particular favourite of Nick Gibb, for example, schools minister. Amanda Spielman has been said to have been looking at knowledge-rich schools, and certainly the advisory board she drew together did have some prominent members of knowledge-rich schools, such as Inspiration Trust in Norfolk, which has been investing a lot in its curriculum design. So yes, there could be said to be a skew towards the knowledge-rich schools in this review. About 1/3 of the 23 schools were identified as being knowledge-led. About a half of them were knowledge-engaged. And then the remaining few were skills-led
curriculums.
So there
were some skills in there.
There were a few skills-led schools in there, yeah.
Great. So what she kind of... I know that she's been accused of, sort of advocating a pub quiz approach to knowledge. What kind of came out of this blog? She defended herself. That's not what she wants.
So she did defend herself, saying it's not pub quiz knowledge. We're not just doing tests about bits of knowledge. It's about, how does knowledge fit in the broader spectrum to a well-structured curriculum? And she does focus on skills. So importantly, she says, knowledge and skills have to be interrelated. The reason to acquire all this knowledge is so that you can apply it. So she has taken the middle road in how she's been speaking about it. She's very, very focused on good, deep, broad knowledge, but she's also talked about how this has to be applied. We're going to wait and see what's going to come out of that next. What her next steps will be. But I think what's interesting to me about this whole thing is it's a great example of a school-led improvement system, actually. Mm. I'm going to go out and say that, because the Conservatives have been focusing on this, academisation as a school-led, self-improving system. And I have to say, when Amanda Spielman made her announcement about, we're going to look for a broad and balanced curriculum, what did happen is that a lot of academy trusts and schools went out and said, how do we do that? If that's what Ofsted wants, how do we do it? They've invested in curriculum leaders. They've looked at designing a good curriculum. Now Ofsted's gone to look at those schools who've taken up the gauntlet, and they've said, what are you doing well and what can we learn from it? So there has been a lot of dialogue back and forth between the regulator and how schools create their curriculum. So I think on the whole, I would say that's a positive move.
It sounds positive. It sounds like it's a good sort of set off against. I'm sure lots of schools might feel like they're in a kind of rock and a hard place, and that they've got all that data that they're meant to be making looking wonderful, and then also might come in and clobber them if they focus too much on core curriculum, right? So it's constantly, you've got to manage everything, but it's good that they're there. I'm sort of interested in what their measure of success of a curriculum is. I mean, how do you sort of work out what that is? I remember I was at an event at the Education Festival, and they were sort of implying that it should enable social mobility, the curriculum. But I don't know if there's any kind of concrete measure yet about what makes a, you know, how do they say, oh yeah, this curriculum's wonderful, Kath. Do we have any idea about that?
Yeah, this is a difficult one. If you look at the DfE's outcome measures for a school, they're focused heavily on performance. So the headline measures are things like progress eight, you've got attainment eight in there. There is a destinations measure, which I suppose is a bit about what you do with it afterwards. The destinations measure hasn't been heavily used by the government. It hasn't been had a massive focus on it. But it's there in their list of performance measures for schools. So there's a possibility at some point it could take more prominence. I think the big tension here that schools feel is between what Ofsted's saying they want it broad and balanced, and what the DfE is saying they want results. And so there's got to be a tension here. How does a school leader decide to keep Ofsted happy or to keep the DfE happy? And hopefully what's going to happen between Ofsted and the Department for Education, and they are very communicative, hopefully is that between them they will find a way to make this work for schools and to make it meaningful for schools. And I am hopeful in that Amanda Spielman is about evidence. She's very, very clear on evidence, and I do think there's a good relationship there with the DfE, and I do hope that maybe there'll be some influence.
Hopefully. So hopefully the pay rise increase, hopefully potentially employer pension contributions increasing, all of that's not going to narrow the curriculum too much with Amanda.
We'll see. Helm. I think for a school leader at the moment, it's still a very tough environment to be making decisions in. I think that's...
It is almost as bad as journalism. No, I'm joking. It sounds worse.
Let's finish on a story that touches a lot of teachers in Nottingham, but could be coming to a city near you.
Hopefully not.
Parking charges for teachers at schools. It's a controversial story of the week. So yeah. What's happening in Nottingham, Jess?
So in Nottingham, we found out an investigation this week. Nottingham City Council have they've had it since 2012, a fee to basically park your car outside the school. It's about £400 per parking spot for the school to pay. What's obviously happened, the school has passed this charge on to the teachers. So teachers are paying anywhere between, I think it was sort of £150 and £500 or something, kind of £2 a week, up to £45 a month, something like that. And so what's happening is lots of teachers instead the idea is to send more teachers onto public transport to enable cleaner air and more sort of less emissions.
Congestion,
and so
which
on.
Seems like a good idea in a city environment. That's right, it's not going to be in rural environments, we're cities. So what's controversial about saying we have to pay for parking to reduce the amount of car usage in a city? What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, obviously teachers don't feel like they have loads of cash swilling around in their pockets to just shell out on car parking fees. Neither do schools. But also anybody who's ever been friends or is related to a teacher, and I am to both of those things, many of them, I have never seen employees who carry so many bags. They have like 20, 30, 40 bags. In fact, one of our... lots of bags full of all those books. So I think one of the issues, and actually Robert Halfen has said this, the chair of the Education Select Committee, is, no, this is unacceptable. We live in a car economy. Teachers need to be able to use their cars, and being charged for that is really pretty unfair.
But how about, what if this were to drive a no marking policy in schools? There we go. What if schools were to say, you can't park, but you can't take books home. We're going to reduce the marking load on teachers. Could that possibly be a good outcome?
I mean, that would be a lovely outcome. I do actually know of a school in Surrey that says you literally have to leave your stuff on the desk, and you are not allowed to take it home. And I think you have to be out the building at 6 p.m. So I guess they wouldn't have a problem. They must just rock up with their phones on a Monday morning. I don't know. No books.
Sounds good to me.
Another one in the northeast, which does a completely no marking policy now. So, but I doubt that a council just suddenly introducing this levy would mean that the school's like, right, no marking. I mean, that would be amazing, but I'm sure there would be a lag of at least a year or two of teachers very stressed. And what about rural schools,
Well, at the moment it's only cities, so I think we've got Cambridge, Reading, Bristol, some cities that I think you've introducing it for now. But I think this is part of a greater trend, isn't it, for councils passing on charges. I think there's been another story about academisation and council charges this week, just to finish up on.
There was. So... And this is just the endless stories of schools being cash strapped and councils being cash strapped, right? So it's just constantly one against the other a little bit. So councils, when a school converts to an academy, they have to do a whole load of tedious work. They have to do sort of legal work, lawyers' fees, HR stuff, moving over the payroll, moving over management information systems, completely changing the status of the school. And this takes up loads of officer time and often thousands of pounds. So we did an investigation, and whereas back in about 2010, I think only five councils were passing on that charge to the school that chose to convert. If anybody can guess how many it is now, 69 now. So loads of councils are passing this charge on.
So then to conclude, I think we'd say that the golden window of academisation is over, potentially.
Potentially. if you didn't want to lose some of your £25,000 grant that enables you to become an academy, you will now have, I mean, there was one school that was being charged 40 grand to convert because it's PFI. Others are charged 15 grand. So, yeah, it's that endless thing of not enough money in the system. Councils want to help. Schools are cash strapped. So, yeah, charge them for parking, charge them to convert. It's a frustrating situation for everyone.
So, yeah, to wrap up, I would say that I think whether the Tories or Labour are going to be in power in the foreseeable future, we're going to have this mixed hybrid economy of schools with local authority maintained schools and academies, and nobody's really going to push it one way or the other. So good luck with that.
Good luck with that. We'll be reporting on it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Don't be shy. Do leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you are listening in. A big shout out to all the entrants to the BET Awards and Reimagine Education Awards. I've been judging both and I can vouch that it is indeed a rigorous process. Phew! Whilst in the Southwest this week, I also got the chance to check out some awesome schools. So a big shout out to Goldworthy Primary, Whitchurch Primary and Horrobridge Primary, as well as Penmore Nursery. Have a great week! And remember, enjoy the small things.